Move the mashed potatoes and scoot over that stuffing, because we need to make room on your Thanksgiving plate for Martin Scorsese's 1978 concert film, The Last Waltz. Stay with us.
Get ready for the 3324 podcast, where lifelong friends Dean Legiro and Eric Cooper share their love of all things music and movies. Dean has directed short films and is a music trivia buff. And Eric, trained in audio engineering, brings his extensive knowledge of music and film to the conversation as they discuss, debate, and celebrate their favorite albums, films, and much more.
Welcome, friends, to this Thanksgiving edition of the 3324 podcast. You're here with Dean Legiro and Eric Cooper, giving you the best in music and film podcasting. Welcome aboard. We are so happy and thankful that you could join us for this episode. Right, Eric?
Indeed we are. Yes. Hello, everyone. Yeah, we're here to talk about something real special. This is, yeah, I think, another one of those subjects that we're pretty much equal on in terms of our passion for it or whatever, yeah, you know, our liking for it. So this is definitely something that is definitely in our wheelhouse that we both equally enjoy.
Well, this is the true definition of the 3324 podcast. This actually encapsulates it, because it is music and it is a film.
A film proper.
Yeah. No, so this is like, you know, this isn't a music video. So this is the concert film, The Last Waltz, which is basically the final live performance or celebration of the group, the band, as they broke up. The concert was 1976. They'd break up in 77. Film would come out in 78. So let me do a couple of stats for this, because we've got it. There's not a lot. It was released in April of 1978. It was filmed on November 25th of 1976, which is Thanksgiving Day. And in an odd happenstance, the Thanksgiving year of 2021, when we're recording this, November 25th is also Thanksgiving. So that's a little kind of, if you're into that superstition thing, well, have at it. Directed by Martin Scorsese, oddly enough. You know him for, and this would be the last film that Eric and I would ever think that we'd be doing as the first Scorsese film. I mean, it could be, you've got your pick, but The Last Waltz is the one. And it features the band, and I'll just run through the members of the band in case if you're not familiar. But you got Robbie Robertson is the main lyricist, which is under some contention as well. And guitarist. You've got Levon Helm on drums and vocals. You've got Rick Danko on bass and vocals, Richard Manuel on keyboards and vocals, and Garth Hudson on keyboards and every other instrument you could think of. He's the musical savant of the group. They all are, actually.
That's true.
The thing about the band, right, is before we even talk about the film, is they really kind of are known for like the Americana style of music, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. The Wait, obviously, is one of their most popular songs, Up on Cripple Creek. So they're known for that whole Americana style of music. But this group is just, this is like the all-stars. They all can play different instruments. You've got three singers in the band, and it's just, so everyone's got multi-tool players in this group.
Yeah. I know Levon Helm. He also plays fiddle.
Fiddle, mandolin.
Mandolin, and he's kind of a. I guess that's where the contention comes in between songwriting chores. I think he likes to take the credit for some of the stuff, and I don't know what exactly who did what there, but it's just, and I know all across the board, you got this band who is just. Who were the backing band for Bob Dylan. And I think they started out as what? The Hawkins.
Ronnie Hawkins backing band first in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Then they graduated to Bob Dylan. When Dylan went electric, he used them. They still didn't have a name, though. They weren't the band at that point. They were just backing band for Ronnie Hawkins and the backing band.
I know they came up with a few titles, and I think they talk about this in the film. Yeah. They're kind of joking around about it, and so they threw some titles out there. But it stuck. And you know what? There it is.
It's simple, and it's direct, and it's really to the point. Yeah. It's the band.
Exactly. Yep.
So they really came to prominence working with Dylan – when Dylan went up to Woodstock and the house in Big Pink, the band, you know, they went up there with him, and a lot of recording, a lot of prolific material came out of that. And then they decided to strike out on their own. So the band, as they're known, was active mainly from 68 to 77, as far as this incarnation of the original members of the group. And they were just, I mean, if you're a backing band for Ronnie Hawkins and Bob Dylan, you're touring all the time. I mean, that's the life. You're on the road, right, out there. If you're a backing band, you're not a recording artist per se. You're out there gigging, right? Mm-hmm. You're constantly doing that. And that was kind of the life that the band had, was constantly touring, constantly being out on the road, and then, of course, making albums. So The Last Waltz would be their final concert before they were breaking up, much at the behest of Robbie Robertson. Everybody, you know, I don't know if it's revisionist history, but everyone now says, or the other members of the band say, well, we really didn't want to. It was Robbie Robertson that was really pushing towards it. And Robbie Robertson's concern was, this is not a sustainable way of life for us, as far as the amount of the amount of drugs that was the amount of drug taking that was going on during this time.
Of course.
You know, he had concerns. He goes, this is just not a way to sustain. And he was actually looking to do, like we've talked about in other episodes, get off the road, but keep the band as a recording concern, and just make music, but not have to tour incessantly.
Right. Much like the Beatles.
Beatles, Beach Boys.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not touring in the 66.
Steely Dan, same thing.
Right. Yeah. But you're talking about, we're talking about circuits that were, they were playing some big arena, big places, but they're also playing a lot of like dives and clubs and, just wherever they could, get the ticket or whatever. So you're talking about some pretty shady circuits, and so all kinds of stuff was happening behind the scenes. So I mean, you've seen it all. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So before we start really getting into it, how did you come to The Last Waltz? When did you first see it?
I first saw it actually in Dobbs, the Pickwick. Really? Yeah, it was in Dobbs Ferry, New York, just where we both grew up. They had a movie theater in town, which did not play first run films when they first came out. They would get it like maybe a year later.
It took a while.
So if this movie came out in 78, I didn't see until probably 79, 80.
Really?
It was around then.
Wow.
Yeah. So they used to play like a lot of the music movies.
Yeah, they used to do the midnight shows
on the weekends. Yeah, sure. So I would go.
Song Remains the Same and Rocky Horror.
Yeah, I saw Kids Are All Right. I saw Woodstock. I saw this film. Unfortunately, at the time, it didn't quite grab me. I didn't know who these people were. I just went, went to see it, and I was impressed with a lot of the stuff that came out of it. But I didn't know who these guys were, I didn't think it wasn't until much later on in like the late 80s, as always with us. I remember watching it with you.
Yeah.
You rented the VHS and we had both been at that point. I think his first solo record came out.
Right. Just around that time. Yeah.
Robbie's first solo record. Yeah.
I actually came to it through a pizzeria. Oddly enough, I was working at a pizzeria in the mid 80s as a delivery, delivering pizza. And there was two guys that owned the pizzeria, and one was really into music. He was, the 80s. So he was a hippie back then, but not during the 80s, but he was into all that stuff. And he used to, and they got this really giant projection TV. And back then that was a kind of a big thing to have a projection TV. Mm-hmm. And it had this giant screen and they had a party room. So they would set it up, and my boss just kept on harping. He's like, you got to watch The Last Waltz. We have to watch it. We have to watch it. I'm like, I'd heard of the Last Waltz as a title.
Yeah. Yeah.
But didn't really know much about it. And right next door to the pizzeria I worked at was a video rental store. So, and in the pizza business, you're working pretty late, like 11 o'clock, whatever. So he rents it like midnight, we're watching The Last Waltz in the pizzeria on this big screen TV.
Okay.
And I, you know what? Mission accomplished. Because I came out of there like a fan of the band. I didn't realize, okay, I knew like a decent amount of the band songs.
Right.
But then there were some other performances. I'm like, wow, just amazed. Mm-hmm. So then, yeah, I pretty much got on the band wagon. Get it? get that?
That's
the,
a good one.
The band wagon?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and then right after that, yeah, not too long after that, Robbie Robertson put out his first solo album. So yeah, there was a nice... Mm-hmm. A nice area or a nice time when I was kind of coming to know the band and then getting some new material from Robbie Robertson, who became one of my favorite artists as well. So,
which we absolutely, I remember really digging on that album so much. I mean, it was such,
which
such
one, Robbie Robertson?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was such different,
God. Love it.
Different sound and, you know, produced by, co-produced by Daniel Lanois, who was, yeah. I became a big fan of him and his production work, working with Peter Gabriel and U2 and
yeah. And, that, so and that's forth. What he did. He grabbed Gabriel and he grabbed U2
right.
and got them involved in Robbie Robertson's solo.
That's very much Robbie Robertson's, thing is, being in the moment of what was going on in the music scene. And you, and this would be inherent in all of his solo work going forward. You would yep. see different artists and different, whatever was, even he even touched upon electronica at one point. He was doing like electronic music and you know, some blues and this and that. And yeah, I just loved the absolute sort of eclectic nature of that record. And yeah. you know, Bodines, that was a band that you they and were, I were yeah. into as well.
Tony Levin was on that album. I yeah. mean, was it Maria McKee from a band called Lone Justice? But
yeah,
the curious thing about Robbie Robertson is recognized as the lyricist, but never sang a song. And really, in the recording of The Last Waltz, famously, the story is his mic was turned off, that because he just didn't have a good voice. So
yeah.
you see him singing throughout the movie, his microphone was not on. So it was really interesting that this guy all of a sudden starts putting out solo albums and he's got an interesting voice, but that's really what I like about him.
Yeah, it's not a croon.
He's not a singer.
He's not a singer. He uses what he's got. I mean, what he's emoting and what's evocative of what he's writing about.
Yeah. He gets it across.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Yep.
And I think it's his guitar playing that really, you know, his distinct.
We'll get to that.
Of course we will.
You just wait. You know what's coming.
I know what's coming. Yeah,
you know what's coming.
It's in the notes.
It's coming. It's on its way. But in the meantime, so Robbie Robertson had this idea. This is not sustainable anymore. The road life is not sustainable anymore. So let's have a concert. We'll have a concert and we'll just kind of have a show and see ourselves out. Right. Basically, mm-hmm. that was the thing. Then it was like, oh, you know, Ronnie Hawkins, let's get him because he was like, you know, our mentor and somebody we worked with. And then before you know it, they start getting all these people to show up for this concert. Robbie Robertson reaches out to Martin Scorsese, does not know him, mm-hmm. but knows he's a music fan and says, hey, would you be interested in filming this for us? Like we got, you know, we're, and this was like 6 weeks before,
yeah,
which is not a lot of time to prep. Really,
it's not. And he was actually working on another film too. I believe he was working on New York. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was thick in the middle of his own career and doing things. And then this Robbie Robertson guy comes up to him and says, hey, would you be able to do this? So they really pulled it together. I mean, they got like Scorsese got a lot of his directors of photography, different people. He worked to be cameraman on this to really just kind of shoestring it. A who's who of talent, right? I mean, Dr. John, Ronnie Hawkins, Muddy Waters, Clapton, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, Neil Diamond, just everybody. And then they secured Bob Dylan, which was the big, Bob Dylan was the big get at the time. So that was the big thing. So, so they put this show together and the fun thing about it is it took place on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So the event actually started at 5 o'clock in the evening. And they served 5,000 turkey dinners to everybody.
That's amazing.
And there was ballroom dancing. So this was held at the Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco, which is legendary music promoter Bill Graham. It was one of his venues. And that was like one of the first venues they ever played as the band or the first venue they played at the band. So they thought it would be apropos to close out their career there. So 5,000 turkey dinners. They had tables set up in the venue, long tables where everybody was eating, and then they moved all the tables and had ballroom dancing.
That's a hell of a Thanksgiving feast, man. What a way to celebrate Thanksgiving.
With 4,999 other friends.
Right.
And then the concert started at 9 p.m. So they had 4 hours of you know, kind of revelry. Mm-hmm. The concert started at 9 p.m. Now, the interesting thing about the movie is, what is it, like 2 hours, give or take, maybe a little bit less? And it's got interviews and it's got other supplemental stuff in there. Mm-hmm. The concert ended at 2:15 a.m.
Yeah.
This was like a 5 hour and change concert.
Yeah.
Not counting the 5 p.m. dinner, the four hours of all that. Then the actual event starts at 9 p.m. doesn't end till 2:15 in the morning.
Yeah, that's amazing.
They should have started it earlier.
I wouldn't have, you know, if you had been there.
It should have been a Thanksgiving lunch.
If you had been there, though, I mean, to have experienced that, that would have been
something. That's an event like nothing else. I mean, you can't pull that off today with having, you know, they have festivals nowadays, obviously, with all that stuff. But going to an event and having a sit-down turkey dinner on Thanksgiving.
It was almost like the end of an era there.
It was a celebration.
Not just for them, but I think, you know, just the music scene in general. Things were changing so rapidly at that point. And as Robbie Robertson pointed out, it was the perfect exclamation point to our, and to have been into the band, to go back and listen to what they've done, to have experienced them and you know, live before. We didn't know any of this. We didn't, when you see the film, but you still feel it. You still feel that emotion. You still feel something from it because it just works so well. And I think, I don't know if it has, obviously the performance is there, but let's give credit to some credit to Scorsese and the way he approached this damn thing, which was very much like a movie in itself. I mean, he went nuts. I mean, he actually, you know, wrote a script, storyboarded the whole thing. He had every camera was manned. It was at the ready. Robbie Robertson his head was spinning. He's like, I can't believe this guy. It's like, I wanted him to film it. But when you film something today, like in a concert, you got guys on the, you know, off the stage and, you know, it's not always perfect and this and that, whatever. This guy had everything, you know, Michael Chapman and bringing his cinematographer. He worked on Taxi Driver. He worked on, you know, Raging Bull and he's completely had the whole thing like planned and set up and it's just amazing to think that, you know, every song, the lyrics were written down. Scorsese went through every song.
He wanted camera angles and camera shots.
The lighting
and everything.
You know, the mood of what the song is. What are the lyrics saying? We got to set the lighting up a certain way. I mean, it's like, how do you do this in six weeks? 6 weeks.
Yeah. Right? You know what, though? It wasn't without its issues, though, because with all those, and it's amazing that they got what they got, because the thing that Scorsese didn't count on as a feature filmmaker and not a documentarian is that film canisters need to be changed out when you run out of film because they shot it on 35 millimeter. So this wasn't digital, right? So you have to change out the film when it happens. And for one performance in particular, Muddy Waters, all the cameras were shut down except for one. And Scorsese, I believe, was telling the guy to shut it down so they can kind of swap everything out. And he's like, no, I'm going to continue to film. And if you watch, it was the one camera shot. And
thank God.
Thank God, because he's
a hell of a performance.
You know, Manish boy.
Yeah, that's right.
So some weird happenstance for that. Audio wise, I'm sure there was enhancing in post production. It sounds incredible, though. I mean, just some of these versions from The Last Waltz, I like better than the studio versions. And I'm usually a hound for the studio version. I don't like the live. I could probably, you know, the night they drove Old Dixie down, forget it.
We'll get to that. That's
we're on it now.
Okay. All right. We'll start there.
The studio version does not hold a candle to that live version.
You will absolutely not hear amazing. A more impassioned performance of that song than what Levon Helm does in that. I mean, it is one of the best performances by a drummer, no less. I mean, this guy sings, and that always impressed me. You know, this guy can, I mean, he has such command, not only of his voice, he's got a very, very strong voice, but also his drumming style is just, you know, he's so on. Yeah. He's so
and the horns in that arrangement of it too.
Oh my
just,
God.
Just a lot. Yeah, there's so much.
I watch it and it brings tears to my eyes every time. It yeah. does. I get, you know, I get emotional about every stupid thing, but seriously, I mean, this was a performance for the ages right there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's great throughout the whole thing, but I mean, just watching him in this song is just, oh yeah. And you know, the horns just drive it home. And even Robbie, it's like, you know, you see him like sort of, he's into it and he's like, you could see that he's singing on the top of his lungs, but you know, even though you can't hear, I wonder if that was Scorsese's decision or if it was it his to keep his mic turned down.
I think it was kind of known. I think that was probably like an, I got the impression it was a normal order of business for the band that his mic was not really ever on.
Yeah.
They made a point to kind of mention it. So I figured that must've been, cause they could have just easy in post-production. It could have easily just, you know, they could have had it on, but then just not used it in the mix. So,
right.
Levon Helm and in this movie as well. So there's a mix of live and then there's like three pre-recorded or post-recorded actually after the concert, they gathered everybody together to do some kind of live in a soundstage performances, which they did the Wait with the Staple Singers, which is a great rendition as well. Yeah. Rick Danko's vocal on that one is just, I love his vocal on that.
Oh yeah.
And then they did Evangeline with Emmylou Harris. Again, just really, just the performances they captured, even though those are on a soundstage and they're not in front of an audience, just amazing renditions.
It really makes it, that's what really elevates it to a film, you know, because you got this live performance and then it cuts to them talking about their experiences. And, you know, it's very much.
And they're all characters. They are not.
I don't think they're sober in any one shot of this movie.
Robertson looks ripped throughout every. That's the thing is in the beginning, like Scorsese, because Scorsese was battling a heavy cocaine addiction at the time.
Yes.
So all these guys were knee deep in the snow.
Yeah,
but there are a couple of those, especially in the beginning, where Scorsese asks Robbie Robertson a question, and he's like, "Why don't you ask me that again?" but they don't. That would normally be the outtake, and you would cut, and then you would have you wouldn't have that in there. But he's like, you know, it's like, "Why don't you ask me
Marty.
That again?"
No, he's not going to cut that. No way. There's no way he's going to cut that.
It was kind of funny. So they left all that rawness in, and these guys are road dogs. I mean, they have stories from the road. They look weary. They all look weary. They look like they've
gives them character though. Yeah. That's what we really get the sense that these guys have been through it. They you know it, and it's a testament to the bands that are some of the bands that are out there today doing it. They're probably doing it smarter because they're not probably partaking in half the substances that were taken at the time.
Jeez.
So they're approaching it in a different way, which is great, but. But yeah, I mean, it's just they're like troopers, man. It's like they've been to a war, and I think they even refer to that. They kind of say that a couple of times throughout the film. Just interesting, and that's one of the most interesting aspects of the film too. Is they just you don't know these guys. We didn't know them back then, but to hear these stories, I'm hooked.
They're funny stories too. They're kind of very off the cuff. Some of them were about the old days or the origins of the music that they play, where it came from rhythm and blues and rock. So you get a little bit of a time capsule of where they were in their career, but then also looking back at the start of their career and how they came up and the band is rock and roll royalty. I mean, they really are. They're not well known. I don't get the feeling that they're well known, though. Even though they're held in such high regard by their peers and everybody else.
They're not your typical.
They're not like the mainstream. Yeah, they're not the mainstream,
but they are well regarded. I mean, in the circle, you know, they're.
So much critically. So that Clapton wanted to join the band. I mean, he literally was leaving. Right, like when Cream broke up, he was going. Woodstock because he goes, I want to join the band. Like, this is the kind of environment I want to be in.
Yeah, he was always looking to just be a guitar player in the band. He never, he was never comfortable with being like a front man. It was Delaney Bramlett that kind of brought him out in that. But I think this was this, I guess it was before the Dominoes, you know, that he did this, because that at that point he did Layla, and then he would go on a solo.
I think that might have been the inspiration for the right. Dominoes. I think he was looking for that kind of a collaborative.
He was definitely Delaney and Bonnie was very similar to these, like these big, huge kind of like showcase kind of bands. You know, you had Joe Cocker's Mad Dogs and Englishmen. You had all these musicians. The spirit of The Last Waltz is exactly that.
Yeah.
And you're getting all these artists on the same stage and sharing in that elevated musical experience is like no other.
Yeah.
Is an amazing, uplifting experience to see and hear.
And the interesting thing about The Last Waltz too is that the performers, that the guests played their own songs. So it wasn't like a tribute. It wasn't like a tribute concert where they came out and played songs by the band. Dr. John comes out and sings Such a Night, which is one of his songs. This was
another interesting aspect of the whole thing was that these artists were what the band was into. Like they wanted to showcase their interests in music and their friends and different aspects, country, blues, folk. You know, whatever they were into, they that's why they invited these artists, because they were representing what they were into and what influenced them in their songwriting and in their own stuff. So it's great that they did their own stuff, them backing them up, but for them to go on and do their own thing too, which is some of my favorite moments is when they do their own songs and there's nobody else around but them, and you know, hearing stuff like, you know, Stage Fright. Which one is another one of my favorites? Danko. That's a great, great performance right there too.
Speaking of Dr. John, real quick.
Yeah.
Do you know that he was the influence or inspiration for another famous doctor? He was the influence for Dr. Teeth, of Dr. Okay. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem.
Yeah, I could
from
see
the
that.
Muppets. He was
okay.
he was the inspiration for Dr. Teeth.
I see it. Yeah, I get. Yeah, I get
Can
that.
Can you picture that?
Yeah.
From the
all right. Yeah. You know,
with that Cajun that you know, New Orleans drawl that Dr. John has. But
that's right.
Yeah, he was the influence for it. So another bit of useless trivia. Just throwing it out there.
I actually got to see him. He opened.
Oh yeah,
for,
Dr. John.
Yeah, he opened for Tedeschi Trucks Band and what?
Wow.
They had like several other artists. You know, it was like St. Pete. And that was great. So he came out and I think he did a couple songs with them. But again, another band that's out there doing this kind of thing and keeping that spirit alive of having
spreading the word
of just playing this great music and showcasing all these different artists and being able to share the stage with someone that influences you or that you might be influencing them. I mean, you know, even bringing in younger artists to, you know, under their wing to push them out in the spotlight too. So
This was just a total celebration of their career. You know, the movie kind of chops up the order, but the concert was the band did all of their material first. So you kind of got a concert of the band doing all their stuff. Then they started, you know, trotting out all the different guests, you know.
We got some special guests here.
You want to talk about an eclectic group. I mean, you've got Neil Diamond to Neil Young.
Yeah,
right? I mean, you know, you're not going to get a and kind of everybody in between, right?
He's like the wild card, isn't he, Neil Diamond? It's like everybody talks about Van Morrison.
Why is he there? Why is Neil Diamond there?
And he's always the one guy that everybody singles it. But he was great. He was absolutely great. Everybody was great. And that's the cool thing about it, though. It's like you don't care. It's like, you know, Neil Diamond. No, you watch him and you love him. You know, because back in the day when when you think about his early stuff, I mean, he was doing very much what a lot of these other artists were doing too. Yeah. I mean, it was very sort of folky, kind of rockish.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, you know, we're thinking of Neil Diamond like later on in years.
Yeah, like Sweet Caroline and, you know.
Right. You know, but.
I mean, he had just worked with Robbie Robertson around that time. So that might have been why he got his ticket.
Yeah, I think Robbie.
I think he co-wrote that song, Dry Your Eyes. I think that Robbie Robertson co-wrote it.
Yeah, didn't he produced his album, right? Robbie produced that record? Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
He was out there. He was doing other stuff, Robbie Robertson, and making his career. And the funny thing, or the interesting thing, I guess maybe we'll take this little off ramp briefly, is that this collaboration between Scorsese and Robbie Robertson would begin a collaboration that goes on to this day.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I think they were living together for a while. I think when Scorsese was having some marital problems or whatever he was going through at this time, I think they were living together. But then Robbie Robertson would find a career as a like composing underscores and sourcing music, because Scorsese is famous now. His movies are famous for using music like Tarantino, of using existing music to punctuate scenes. And Robbie Robertson really did that for him. He started with Raging Bull, I think, then King of Comedy. Did not do Goodfellas, but then did Casino, Shutter Island, Wolf of Wall Street, The Irishman. So this is a collaboration that has gone on for years, where he uses him to help source the appropriate pre-recorded music, but then also compose underscores. And I didn't know he co-wrote It's in the Way That You Use It for Clapton.
Yeah.
I didn't know Robbie Robertson.
Yeah, that was for The Color of Money.
Color of Money.
Yep. Yeah, which he picked all the artists off on that soundtrack. Yeah, so that, you know, including Clapton, which again, Robbie would have that relationship with him. So I guess let's go. We're going to talk. We're going to go there. Let's go there. Dean has been busting my chops
for years. So how do we set this up? Let me see. I mean, okay. Eric has always been into Eric Clapton for a long time. It's always been one of his favorite artists. Like it's like his number one, it's his passion. And you really, it's a great watch, and it's a weird occurrence that happened in the film, but it's something that I take the opportunity to bust Eric up about every chance I get. And we haven't talked about it in a while. So his wounds have probably healed and he's ready. So Clapton comes out and he does his song is further on up the road. He decides to do that cover, which is a classic, you know, it's a blues song. It's one of his, one of his easy peasy ones.
Yeah,
you have to watch the video. You have to watch the movie though, and you got to pay attention because Clapton comes out, you know, wearing his velvet tux,
of course, yeah,
and his you know 2-week beard or whatever. But you have to watch his guitar, because his guitar strap is not put on properly. It's actually put on backwards. So and Clapton has one of the most easygoing, like he is one of the smoothest players I've ever seen. Like he just plays like he's not, he plays like he's like writing, like it's just so effortless and kind of just easy.
Very fluid. Yeah.
Very fluid. Thank you.
And simple.
So what happens is he's playing the intro to Further On Down the Road and kind of doing his whole intro soloing and stuff like that. And the strap, because it's not put on right, the guitar drops out of his, you know, he doesn't drop it all the way, but it drops off the strap and he kind of loses it and catches it. And Robbie Robertson comes right in, like did not miss a beat, like saw what happened, had a like was ready just to lay out a solo and just kind of like picked it up. Probably one of the better, you know, he's not a great soloist, Robbie Robertson. He's you know, he's got a particular guitar sound, but he's certainly no Clapton. Let's put that.
Well, to his credit. Okay, here's the thing. You a lot of people, and this is an actual debate, okay, amongst, you know, people at large, because
let's hear it.
It's a, you know, they people kind of saw it as it was like a competition. They were like, you know, competing against one another. I look at it from the standpoint of, you got two great guitar players, like you say, Robbie just came right in without missing a beat. That goes to show you how professional, how in tune they are listening to one another. Because if you listen to Clapton coming back, you know, once he gets the guitar strap, you know, Robbie comes back with this, he fires off this really great solo.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. It is. And you could, you could argue, you know, he blew Clapton away. You know, that's like, oh, you know.
Round one went to Robbie Robertson.
Just in the tone alone of his guitar, because he had such a fiery, different sound.
Yeah.
And Clapton was doing this thing. And even Clapton, I'm sure he was amazed. And this is something that he loves, is like he watches other guitar players. He, you know, at the beginning, it might have been something like, okay, these guys are the competition or whatever. Maybe there's some ego there. I don't know. I, you know, whatever.
I never thought of it that way. Yeah, I never really thought of it that way.
But if you really listen though, if you take the time to, like, you know, you could watch it, but I think if you actually listen to the audio portion of it, you hear Clapton come back. And what he's doing is, when Robbie's still playing the solo, Eric starts playing rhythm. you hear it. You mm-hmm. hear him come right back in, yep. and he knows exactly where to come right back in to play, just finish out his solo, and then he comes in with his solo.
Yeah, yeah. Robbie Robertson kind of hands it off, like kind of, you know, that winds down what he's doing. And it almost kind of, if you watch the movie portion, he almost kind of motions towards Clapton, like,
Eric's kind of standing there. Yeah. You know, he knows. He's like, he's standing there smiling, but
he's waiting for a spot.
He's waiting, but he knows instinctively where to come in. And Robbie yeah. would comment on this, actually, on the Clairvoyant album that they did together, mm-hmm. That, you know, Clapton guested on. In the liner notes, Robbie said, he goes, Eric has always been, he's always had a knack for knowing exactly when to come in mm-hmm. on a song and when not to, and what not to play. Like, yeah. it's that to me is just is every bit as great as like just coming, you know, firing off one guitar solo after another. It's like yeah. these guys, it's a conversation. They know how to speak to one another with the guitar.
Yeah.
And that's impressive.
Yeah, no, yeah, that was I never thought of it as they're competing against each other. I just thought it was always funny how Eric Clapton was held in such high regard, and then mm-hmm. like Robbie Robertson had like the one shot,
yeah, like, and he did
of this freak thing that happened,
and he took his shot
in, and because his second solo wasn't as good, but that solo was just snappy, it was peppy, it was jumpy,
yeah.
And it was a counterpunch to the way Clapton plays.
But when
Clapton,
by the end of the song, when you hear them both together,
yeah,
and how they're harmonizing, Clapton has that higher pitch and this tone. It's yeah. phenomenal. I mean, yeah. I think it's one of the biggest crowd moments. On if you listen to the audio yeah. on oh, the yeah. album, it's like that's the one moment where they turn up the crowd, like you know, like. But it's just yeah. I mean, it was you know. But I think, you know, and Clapton himself would probably say, yeah, I was probably drunk off my ass anyway. Because, you know, like he probably yeah, who was.
They all were.
Or who wasn't. Right? Yeah, right. Yeah. But I actually got to see them that recreated at Crossroads. I mean, uh-huh. he invited Robbie to come out and they did that song again. And he introduced Robbie as Robbie introduced him, you know, uh-huh. playing guitar, you know, and they came and they recreated it and they, you know, it was great. That it wasn't as great as that performance, obviously.
No, because you can't recreate the accident that happened.
No, you don't. You don't recreate that, right.
purely something that probably a guitar player never wants to have happen is the strap on hooks from the guitar and it he didn't drop it. It fell out of his grasp and he grabbed it long enough for literally like 2 seconds, maybe not even.
Most
and Robbie just came right in and just like I got you.
Yeah, I would think that most people would be rattled by that, there was just no way to come back from that. Yeah. You know what I mean? But he did, and you know, I give him credit and
yeah, picked it right up.
Yeah, it's such a great moment, and yeah, it's one that we've always
a lot of grief about it just because I knew it irked
yeah.
you. Like it irked you that I would keep doing it. That's
right.
Why
he was like, "Oh, you blew him away." It's like, but I never, like I said, I might have thought that back in the day, but now it's like, yeah, you really you get a better sense of who they are as musicians.
The camaraderie was absolutely there.
Yeah,
it certainly wasn't a you know a Steve Vai, Ralph Macchio, you know, Crossroads duel type thing. It was you know He stepped in, was able to provide a really nice solo and kind
yeah.
of keep the song moving right before it broke down or oh we got to you know let's do it again because the song just started. They could have easily just said you know what, let's start over again,
right?
They could have just easily right. done that because it had just literally started and said no, let's you know Robbie picked it up and kind of vamped that solo till Clapton was ready and then handed it back off to him too.
And what a solo it was! I give Robbie. I mean he absolutely. Blew it out of the water. I mean, it was just, it's a great, great moment, you know?
Yeah.
One of the better, it's one of my favorite moments in rock history, actually. You know, when you think about the mistakes, like that, you don't really hear or see that often, you know, it's just, but it's there and it, you know, it's one of the great, great moments. So.
Yeah. It's just amazing. And you know, Neil Young, I mean, another fellow Canadian comes out and does Helpless and, Joni Mitchell helps out on kind of like some of the backing vocals, but they kept her off stage and you see it in the film, you hear her singing and you're like, is that Joni Mitchell? Then they cut to her and she's like in the dark, like in a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why they did that is they didn't want her to come out on stage yet because they didn't want to ruin like her entrance.
Her moment. Yeah.
Yeah. So they kind of kept her off stage doing the backing vocals. So you didn't know it was her if you weren't paying attention. So this way she didn't kind of have anything kind of, and it didn't, you know, kind of take away from Neil Young as well. And she did Coyote, which was a great song.
Oh, it's one of my favorites. It's such a great, great performance of that too. I just love that jazzy feel, just a nice mix of talent.
Mm-hmm. You know, of these people that they got. Yeah, some, you know, like how does Neil Diamond fit in with Neil Young and Muddy Waters?
And Muddy Waters.
Like all these, so you can kind of be like, well, Dr. John, Ronnie Hawkins, and Muddy Waters are kind of like the bluesier part. And then Clapton kind of is the blues and rock.
He's English blues and he's, you know, so and
then
again.
You can try to transition into the singer-songwriters with Neil Diamond, you know, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell. So there, if you think about it, there is some groupings.
Yeah.
You know, and then my favorite performance, friggin' Van Morrison, Caravan. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. When I saw that, it makes me smile every time. He left leisure suit. the burgundy suit with the lace-up pants in the front.
Oh my God. And skin tight.
Yeah. And he wasn't Elvis fat, but he wasn't the fittest at the time.
No, he was not. Certainly not. That's when he started gaining that, you know.
His performance of Caravan, he left everything out on the stage. Because I was just listening before we went on, I went to Spotify and I was listening to the, you know, that anniversary edition there. And it's got the rehearsal version of Caravan.
Yeah.
And you can hear him not giving it everything that he would, because when he does it for the filming, his voice must have been shredded because he literally left everything out on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then the end, when the band is just playing, got the horns going, and he's kind of James Browning it, like he's leaving, but then he's like kicking in the air, and then he's not leaving, and the band is still trying to playing him off.
Yeah. Oh.
I always, from the beginning when I first saw that film, that's really my introduction to Van Morrison. I didn't really know a lot. You kind of know this or that.
Right.
But I was like, wow, this guy really, like, he gets like the gold star, the gold medal, I think, for just best and most fun performance to watch went absolutely to Van Morrison.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you could definitely say that, but it's like, to me, the whole film is just extraordinary and very few have matched it. If any, like of all the concerts.
We've talked about this. And I think the closest I said, and for me, like this was the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I mentioned to you that possibly the concert for George might have the edge.
Yeah.
As far as like a, you know, something that is just absolutely amazing of the same type caliber. Of course, they're all doing George Harrison songs, but just from the lineup and the quality of the arrangements and everything, it was just, you know, I think it's up there with The Last Waltz.
I think so too.
As
a concert film, sure. But I think the concert for George was, for me, emotional in a different way. It was slightly more somber. It had to be.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah,
it was more in reverence to George, and it was a celebration of his life. And so there were some real sort of like it had that gravitas to it. You know, in certain moments, especially like the beginning before the Beatles stuff with Ravi Shankar, and then Jeff Lynne came out and did Inner Light and.
Who can I?
Once again, here we go. The usual suspects are.
I think this is going to end up being like Jimmy Kimmel and Matt Damon, where they kept on saying, you know, we want to have Matt Damon on, or kind of like what's up with that on SNL with Lindsey Buckingham?
Oh, there you go. That's an even.
And no time for Lindsey Buckingham tonight. But and he's like, oh, okay.
Have you seen the latest one?
Yeah, with the guy pretending to be like he said it was him,
and it's like it's the best costume ever.
It was like, oh my God,
I was dying. It was so
and then
funny.
And then I think Lindsey Buckingham tweeted like, hey, it was great being on SNL for that episode because he was totally took it to the next level. But I think that's the one. I mean, and there's, you know, people might make a case for Song Remains the Same. There's not a ton of concert films Stop Making Sense. Another big one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I mean, there was a lot of of those type of films, but this one was, like you said, it had that film quality to it because it was part had documentary elements to it.
Yeah.
Also. So it wasn't just a straight up filmed performance, which Concert for George was straight up filmed performance. Song Remains the Same, filmed performance, not really documentary. It had those weird interludes of like the film stuff, like with the
they tried to get a little artsy with it. Yeah, there
was just riding through the countryside on a horse, and
to be frank, and to be honest with you, I actually had my brother had the vinyl, the soundtrack
for Song Remains the Same,
and I didn't like it. I thought it was horrible at the time. This is not. They don't sound good. They just, I think Robert Plant, his vocals were just not quite there for me.
Just for everybody, that's Eric.
But,
saying that.
But I, of course, over the years, you realize that this is rock and roll.
Yeah.
Because we're so in tune with what's going on in the studio. We want things perfect when you're young, it's not going to sound that way in a live, not always. But
you would think though, with a live thing that they're recording, that they would put their best foot forward.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you a little inside baseball, just like about how how The Last Waltz, they filmed those soundstage things and they had to sweeten some things up. For Song Remains the Same, they actually had to refilmed some of that stuff too. Like they didn't for the Madison Square Garden gig where they filmed it, they didn't get all the footage they wanted. So they actually brought them back out, made them wear the same clothing and filmed everything, like them miming. So they can get close-ups and stuff like that. And you can tell because you'll see like nothing behind them a lot of times. So,
yeah.
Little inside.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, before we move on to like the aftermath, but we didn't talk about Dylan.
Okay.
In the Last Waltz too. This was a fiasco. This was typical Dylan, right? A lot of the investors in this film got made because of the promise of Dylan, like showing up and being a part of the project, right? I mean, he still had that clout and that pull that, Dylan's going to be there. Okay. Then we'll do this.
Yeah.
So they're filming throughout the day, right? And this thing started filming at 9 o'clock and there was an intermission at some point and Dylan goes up and says, I don't want you filming me. You're not going to film any of my stuff. I was like, are you for real? Like you're pulling this now, the night of the show during intermission, and you're coming here and saying you don't want us to film anything. So people were livid. It was panic in the streets.
Yeah.
And he wasn't listening to anybody. So what they, there was a couple of reasons. He had made a film that was coming out soon. And I guess he felt like he didn't want that to be this to step on that. Again, legendary concert promoter Bill Graham. Bill Graham is probably the only person that Dylan will listen to. So, Bill Graham went over to Dylan and said, "Listen, you got to be reasonable."
Mm-hmm.
They came to a compromise. They actually did not get to film his whole thing. He said, "You can film like 4 songs out of my set." It was like, freaking Dylan, like this guy doesn't stop. He doesn't stop making people miserable and just making it harder for people to like him. But you still like it. You still have to like him because of that.
You got to give the guy credit.
He's got a set of stones on him. You do that the day of, you're not going to film me. Like, really? So I think they made the agreement also was, okay, you know what? Let us film you. This film won't come out until after your film comes out. And it was some weird thing he made, and it bombed anyway, and hasn't never even been released on VHS or DVD. The one that Dylan made. So it was all for naught, but they came to the agreement, and he did, Forever Young. Let me follow you down. Baby, Let Me Follow You Down. And then I Shall Be Released as well. Those were the ones that they captured on film. But he did a bunch. He did Hazel and he did I Don't Believe You. So there was a couple of other songs that he had done, but they just
didn't need to Love Minus Zero. No,
no.
Or was what am I thinking? I might have been his 30th anniversary show that they did that. Okay.
Yeah. So and then at the end, they had everybody come out for the obligatory jam session. They added, Ringo Starr for some reason. It's like, yeah, come out and hit the drum. I know it's always weird. It's always weird when they trot him out. Like, it's always weird when they trot out multiple drummers at these things because they're only going to reuse one. They did it at the concert for George. They're like, yeah, eight drummers out and Ray Cooper and every percussionist under the sun. They're only going to use one drum track because all the guys are doing like all these fills. Everyone's doing fills. You can't have a song with 20 fills every eight bars.
No, it's an absolute disaster. It's a mess.
I just thought it was always strange when they bring out extra drummers. Like, yeah,
well, especially Ringo. And they just throw him in everything. I mean, yeah, the guy he's everywhere, right?
You get him for the name. Nothing against Ringo drumming. I'm not making that point. I'm just saying, you know, it's overkill when you have multiple drummers at these shows and these kind of tributes and these farewell shows. It's like, you don't need three drummers.
Well, getting back to Dylan, it's cool that, I mean, you know, at least he did show up, unlike the concert for George, which that's the one thing I was disappointed.
Was he invited?
Why did he not take part in that?
Was he invited? That's the question, I guess.
I don't know. He should have been. You think he would be, right? I mean, you know, Wilbury and, you know, whatever, but
maybe that's why.
I think that's where frankly, that's, you know, that the relationship that Harrison and Dylan had was a hell of a lot longer than, you know, the relationship with Petty and Jeff Lynne
I mean, he covered If Not For You on All Things Must Pass. I mean, yeah, he's been a Dylan fan from the jump.
That always seemed odd to me, and I never really.
He's too quirky. That's why. Maybe Dylan was like in California touring and couldn't fly to Albert Hall or wherever. Like, you know, it could have been a scheduling thing too. Get there for the one.
I tend to think
everything else. But
I tend to think otherwise. But
yeah, but knowing what we know and our experience with him as well, he probably just did it to spite. He was probably making his bourbon and his whiskey. So they would wind, you know, the concert would end, obviously, Thanksgiving of 1976. The film wouldn't come out till 2 years later because, yeah, like we said, Scorsese was in the middle of filming New York, New York with De Niro and Liza Minnelli. So he actually had to get back to that. And then in the interim, after the band finished that show, they did film the supplemental stuff afterwards, some interviews, this, that, and the other thing. And then they actually did owe their record label one more album. So they didn't break up that night. It was kind of like their farewell and their send off, but they didn't actually break up until 77. They would release their last album, I believe was called Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And at least for this, this incarnation of the band, because like we said, this was mainly a Robbie Robertson fronted concern of getting off the road and breaking up and things just kind of fizzled out. And then the band would kind of reconvene in around 83 without Robbie Robertson. And it just wasn't the same.
No.
You know, and I think we can talk about the whole songwriting thing because I think it's important to mention that, you know, Levon Helm puts out his autobiography and he's like, oh, you know, everybody collaborated and he took advantage, Robbie Robertson, this, that, and the other thing. I think the biggest tell is Robbie Robertson, for all of his solo work, writes all the songs. If you look at any of Levon Helm's solo work, I think he's written one song.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else was written by somebody else or a cover. So not to choose sides, but I think if you just look at it objectively, if he's this prolific songwriter or did all this songwriting, how come he didn't write any songs for any of his subsequent solo work or the stuff for the band?
That's correct.
Right? They would have, with Robbie Robertson not in the band after 83, because they did start recording again, you would have an opportunity then to, you know, do what you wanted to do.
It's kind of like the kind of reminds me of Ginger Baker talking about Cream in that sense, like, mm-hmm. Jack Bruce got all the songwriting credits, like lyrically and, you know, but, oh, you know, everything went to Jack Bruce and Pete Brown, who was his collaborator, mm-hmm. you know, but Ginger Baker would be like, no, Eric and I, you know, we did these little parts and we collaborated on this. So yeah, it's very, very similar in that sense of probably bits and pieces of.
Yeah. So to what extent
like a song, like a melody, like, but lyrically speaking, you could definitely tell. I mean, Robbie just has that knack. I mean, he's just.
Yeah. His songwriting was consistent, at least in the themes and in the way he writes songs. His solo work doesn't sound like the band because he doesn't sing like any of those experts.
Right.
But the way he writes lyrics is very consistent and very much in the vein of the previous material. So, yeah, kind of like the whole, you can nitpick it of saying, yeah, to what extent does someone's collaboration grant them authorship, right? Mm-hmm. Or grant them a songwriting credit? If you said, oh, you know, use the word farmhand instead of farmer or something, like, does that mean that you, does it mean you fundamentally helped write the song? Or, you know, or, you know, if you made a couple of suggestions, does that mean you helped change the way the song was going to be? And is that enough? Right. Mike Love went through it with the Beach Boys. Yeah. He ended up getting credit though. So he was in the right in that one of, yeah, I wrote a lot of this stuff. I contributed with the band. I'm not so sure. I'm going to tend to skew towards Robbie Robertson was writing everything, and maybe there was some input. But again, how far does that go towards songwriting credit? There's a fine line, which we certainly weren't there for.
Which in a way is, you know, it's kind of hard to think about, because like we said before, I mean, you're talking about these guys, or some of these guys are like classically trained musicians. I mean, you know, these are, you know, people who are composers of music. We're not just talking about writing a song. We're talking about melodies and laying down that kind of thing. How much of that does anybody get credit for? You know, you wonder, you know, did Robbie Robertson write the entire, you know, piece of music to it, or the accompaniment, and whatever it was, you know? So I think everybody had their little part to play, but it's hard to say who gets what credit in that sense. I definitely think there are certain songs that you could definitely know right out the gate who wrote what. I think Robbie, for the most part, I know that he wrote some of the more popular stuff. But then, you got Rick Danko, who had his own, he made a few solo albums as well.
Yeah, and unfortunately, most of the members of the band have passed away. Richard Manuel, unfortunately, took his own life at the age of 42. Rick Danko would die a few years after that, and then Levon Helm would pass in 2012. So the only two surviving members of the band are Robbie Robertson and Garth Hudson. And Garth Hudson is pretty much up there. He's like 84 or something like that. So he's up there.
It's a shame. It really is. You never know what transpires, you know.
So then Martin Scorsese would go on to to bigger and better, right? This was almost like a brief stop in his career of, let me just do, you know, I've been asked to do this. But again, he got Robbie Robertson signed to an acting contract, and Robbie Robertson did a movie called Carney. Because after United Artists or MGM saw him in The Last Waltz, I'm like, oh, this guy could probably be an actor. And he did do some acting, Robbie Robertson. I mean,
well, he definitely has the look, right? He's kind of a handsome, I mean, he's got that kind of movie quality to his features, right? You know, he's got that voice too. When he speaks, he's got that low timbre to his voice. Like in a lot of the songs that he does, I mean, he actually talks, and it's a spoken word kind of thing, which we love. You know, I just Somewhere Down the Crazy River, and you know, that kind of stuff is just, it's just great stuff.
Sonny Got Caught in the Moonlight, I love Sonny that. That's with Rick Danko. Yep. Rick Danko helps him out on that too. But he did some acting, wasn't he in I think he was in that movie The Crossing Guard with Nicholson. I think Robbie Robertson was like the husband of Angelica Houston or something like that.
I think you're right. Yeah,
I think so. So he kind of not only was doing the music thing, but was also doing some of the acting as well. So he was a well-rounded gentleman, and then of course guesting on like you said, some of the Crossroads of Eric Clapton's Crossroads tours.
Well, I that was the pinnacle, was the 2007 one for me. A lot of great things happened in that show, and he only came out for two songs, but that was enough for me.
Yeah.
I was over the moon that I got to see Robbie Roberts, because we always wanted like certain other artists that, you know, we never got to see live.
And he doesn't tour. You know, yeah, it's not like he tours.
No.
Yeah,
but he did. He with the Clairvoyant album, he toured. And he toured with Dawes, I recall. Oh, yeah.
See, I missed that.
They were his backing band. Yeah, they were his backing band, because he was really like the Bodines. Like this is this brand new band I really like. I think they're gonna be my backing band for this it wasn't a major tour, but mm-hmm. he, you know, he played some dates. Yeah. Cool. So, yeah. But
interesting. The Last Waltz, a Thanksgiving, you know, and that's the funny thing is this movie was filmed on Thanksgiving, but
yeah,
for some reason, Alice's Restaurant by Arlo Guthrie seems to be the song that's always played on Thanksgiving. Right? I don't know if are you familiar with that song?
Yes, of course.
Like yeah. That became like a Thanksgiving tradition. I got to see this in the theater like the day before Thanksgiving a couple of years ago because they showed it in like, you know, like one of the music halls or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great because I was in there with a bunch of people. Everyone clapped after each song. So it was like going to a concert. But I think this is a really great Thanksgiving tradition because it happened on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great one. It's a great one to pull out for this holiday if you're going to be traveling. You're going to have people around or you want something on in the background, you could put on The Last Waltz.
I totally agree. And given that the fact that it's the 25th, yeah. Which is the day it actually happened, I think
no better way to celebrate.
Absolutely.
No better way
to talk about like, what are some of the things that we watch on Thanksgiving Day? Yeah.
King Kong.
Where did that come from? Like, how did that become a Thanksgiving tradition?
Because I think they cut out a scene on Skull Island where he killed a prehistoric turkey, like a giant turkey, but they cut it out. So it's just, you know.
It's just bizarre how these things, for 10 years, that thing was on every year. Yeah. Son of Kong, yeah. Mighty Joe, like when did this become a tradition? And you got stuff like The Last Waltz, which.
Sitting in the can waiting, it actually happened on Thanksgiving.
Right, exactly. You know, maybe we should start our own.
Well,
you know, we'll start our own tradition. Hopefully, people will.
Hopefully, you'll check this out.
Yeah,
absolutely. It for us, it's a. I think of it as a Thanksgiving watch now because of when it happened. So now that everyone else is aware that it was a Thanksgiving Day occurrence, hopefully you'll add it to your rotation of things mm-hmm. to watch or have on in the background. So, I think that's going to do it for this Thanksgiving themed. Episode of the 3324 podcast. We're going to leave the whole social media thing to the side and thank everybody for joining us on these voyages and trips through music and movies that we so enjoy and love. We are grateful for your support. So we're going to leave it there for Eric. This has been Dean. Everybody have a happy Thanksgiving. But don't forget to please be kind and rewind.
You've been listening to the 3324 podcast with Dean Legiro and Eric Cooper. You can find us on your favorite podcast provider. So please like, subscribe, and rate to become a part of the 3324 family. Your feedback is important. So make sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at 3324 podcast and on Twitter at 3324p to join the conversation.